I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. What would it take to make political discourse compelling again? Open, authentic, rational, even believable from time to time. What we're getting used to, what the archaeologists won't believe when they dig up the early Trump era, sounds like this. Just on the matter of Russiagate, for example.
We are at war with Russia. Or perhaps more correctly, we have lost a war with Russia without a battle. We are no longer a sovereign nation. We are no longer a democracy. We are no longer a free people. We are the victims of a bloodless coup. So far, a bloodless coup.
We have never taken seriously from the very beginning, Russia hacked our election. That was a 9/11 scale event. They attacked the core of our very democracy. That was a Pearl Harbor scale event.
President Trump is accusing President Obama of wiretapping him. Minutes ago, the president tweeted, "Terrible. Just found out that Obama had my wires tapped in Trump Tower."
Admit it. You love it when Donald Trump tweets.
I do. I do love it.
Among the professionals in that little sample, Keith Olbermann of MSNBC and Tom Friedman of the New York Times. But people say it's darkest before dawn and all things are possible. This hour, we'll have a taste of something different, maybe promising and contentious. Our guest, Julius Krein, has unveiled the first issue of his new magazine called American Affairs, a sober and readable journal of Trumpist thinking. Just a year ago, another young daredevil in our neighborhood and our studio this hour, Nathan Robinson, launched his Current Affairs, slick and caustic from the left side of the plate, but spot on prophetic about the doomed Democratic candidacy of Hillary Clinton, months before it happened. Chris Hedges is with us listening, a model of independent journalism in my generation, and he will speak up in a bit about the pitfalls ahead in the commentary trade. But first, the newcomers, average age 29, Julius Krein has been working in the investment business, but thinking political ideas in the 8 years since he graduated from Harvard. Nathan Robinson has finished all but his PhD thesis in sociology at Harvard. In addition to his magazine, Nathan Robinson published a book early this year titled Donald Trump, Anatomy of a Monstrosity. Julius Krein, I want to cut to the chase. Would you go so far as to say that there is a big idea or set of ideas embodied in the triumphant Donald Trump, who's still beleaguered? If there is, what would it be? What might it be?
Well, embodied is an interesting word because it suggests that he might represent something larger or deeper than himself, which I think is true, and I think why he managed to win. Obviously, he does not express himself in any systematic or theoretical way. He may not even have an inkling of what he represents. But he did manage to represent a critique of neoliberalism. And what was unique about him is that he attacked both parties, not only the Democrats, but also his own. And he won on that. And I think his critique of so-called globalization as represented by trade agreements, by foreign adventurism and so on in foreign policy, and also by a sort of borderless, unrestricted immigration policy, does sort of coalesce into a critique of a broader post-war, post-Cold War neoliberal consensus that I think is failing and has failed. And whether he knew it or not was the reason for his success.
We'll try to take that apart. But first, just on this matter of the fighting spirit, the physical presence, the WrestleMania echoes of a kind of contest in the moment. Not a lot of history around it, not a lot of future. What is that about? What's the idea therein?
I think you're referring to some remarks I gave at a recent our recent launch event for American Affairs, in which I discussed Roland Barthes' essay, The World of Wrestling, in which he describes wrestling as representing a sort of spectacle of excess. And it's able to be that sort of spectacle of excess precisely because it's all about the standalone postures in the moment and doesn't have any logic of a future. And I think that actually has been true of our politics for the last several years. Donald Trump certainly did not invent that.
but it may be an explanation for why his style managed to win.
Spectacle of excess. There's Donald Trump in three words. We for it or against it? Is it? Why does it win? Where is it going?
I would say that I'm against it. I think we need something better. But perhaps the only way to overcome it, and again, I don't. This was true long before Trump came around, is perhaps to sort of have someone embrace it fully, and from there you can rise from the ashes.
Nathan Robinson, are we ready for a contest of ideas, around ideas, those or others? Is this the moment?
Well, I certainly think it's absolutely true. I mean, I would agree that Donald Trump's victory in some sense represents a reaction to a stale set of neoliberal policies that have caused widespread disaffection, that there are parallels between the rise of Trump and the rise of nationalism elsewhere, the Brexit vote in Great Britain. So I do think that it's important to discuss how political ideas have failed and how Trump might be a backlash to those things. I think I would disagree that Trump represents a particularly new and coherent philosophy, in that I think beneath a lot of the anti-globalist rhetoric that Trump issues forth is a pretty standard set of Republican policies. You really see that, I mean, as soon as he got into office, you saw that basically he's not that far different from a typical conservative Republican, promising to cut taxes, promising to bomb ISIS, restricting immigration. These are not much of a departure from the far right, and the things that were much of a departure, I mean, other than the TPP, a lot of the things like the whole drain the swamp rhetoric he dropped immediately after taking office. Newt Gingrich and Corey Lewandowski basically conceded that that was just a piece of campaign rhetoric. It didn't mean anything. So does Donald Trump actually represent a departure from orthodox policies and a new way of doing things? I don't really think so. It may be true, but I have a sense that he's going to represent a continuation with most orthodox far-right conservatism in America.
That's a question for Judas. There's a funny reverse order here. The traditional notion is that bands of intellectuals invent candidates. In this case, the candidate came fully clothed, and it's been the intellectual task to dope it out. Does he know he embodies these ideas? Are you being loyal to him or he to you? Is there any connection here? There are a lot of all the citations that fill your first issue, Julius, of de Tocqueville and Hegel and Plato would be brand new to our man Trump, right?
Well, certainly his familiarity with great thinkers doesn't seem to be particularly high, but I think it's too early to say. And I think the charitable interpretation is that he can sort of grow into this role, and perhaps a lack of ideology may help him with that. But I wouldn't say that, you know, there's any evidence that he's doing that so far. That's merely one interpretation of it. It is, however, the interpretation that American Affairs is putting out, or at least putting together those sorts of ideas in hopes that he will follow them. It's an interesting, if I may add, a sort of sociological question as to why it took so long for something like this to come about. These ideas, a lot of these ideas are not new. A lot of these our writers have been writing for a while. And in fact, the origins of this publication go back for a while, and it just sort of came to fruition in the last few months. So that the timing is interesting. It presents a unique set of challenges on the one hand, making it more difficult for us to perhaps be independent from the administration. On the other hand, perhaps gives it a bit more relevance and the potential to be more influential than it otherwise would have been.
Where are you in relation to Steve Bannon in what we used to call the war for the president's mind?
I wouldn't know. I've never met Steve Bannon. You know, he certainly has some interest in ideas, but at the same time, like Trump, perhaps he's one of the few Americans who suffer from, or few elite Americans, shall we say, who suffer from undereducation rather than overeducation, in my view. So it will be interesting to see, you know, what his views actually are. I wouldn't claim to know myself.
I've been through your first issue with great interest, 160 pages, read too fast, but the lead piece by your man, a political scientist at Georgetown University, fascinated me. there's a different framework, a different calendar, a different sense of history that runs through the whole thing. Your guys seem to begin at 1848. That was the big turn for de Tocqueville, the beginning of the present era. But the Georgetown man argues that we're in a post-1989 world since the end of the Cold War, the unipower, the unipolar world of American power, in a way, but in which he says the dominant ideas are embodied in globalization and identity politics. That's what we're confronting. What does that mean? What does that imply about our politics or Trump's?
He makes a very interesting reference to Hobbes and the authorship of Leviathan, which of course came out of the various English Civil War and struggle over religion. And Hobbes talks about the temptation of subnationalism and supranationalism or globalism, which are both sort of perennial temptations of the human heart, as Mitchell describes it. And ultimately, these things, for Hobbes and for Mitchell as well, both fail to provide for commodious living and a sustainable sort of human community.
Does that sound anything like your agenda, Nathan?
No, well, firstly, I mean, I think a lot of the what American Affairs is putting out, this idea that Trumpism forms a coherent philosophy and trying to link it back to Hegel or Tocqueville or whatever, ends up really putting an intellectual gloss on something that ultimately is a very primal retreat into cruelty and fear. It sounds great to compare to think about how what Hobbes can tell us about Trump, but in fact, what Trump represents, the ideas, to the extent that Trump represents a set of ideas, he represents the idea that an anti-diversity, anti-humanist, anti-immigration, anti-welfare and prosperity. You can see it in the things they write. The lead writer for American Affairs, Michael Anton, has said diversity is a source of weakness and tension, that Islam is a militant faith. What good has Muslim immigration done for the United States and the American people? We are a nation of settlers, not a nation of immigrants. So it's a very, very primal and divisive
nationalistic philosophy. Stand by, Nathan Robinson. We've just well begun. Coming up in the senior rank of anti-corporate journalists, the thoughtfully scathing Chris Hedges. This is Open Source. We're talking about new blood with the new blood in what can seem like the exhausted game of political media, with also an eminent survivor of New York Times journalism at its bravest. Chris Hedges covered wars in Central America, in the Balkans, in the Middle East, before he was eased out of the Times for speaking out against the Iraq War, whereupon he wrote the tract that still stings, "War is a force that gives us meaning," about war and journalism. Chris Hedges' column in Truth Dig this week, in the opening line, led into the liberal elites who bear significant responsibility for the death of our democracy. Vintage Hedges, if I may say, Chris. Can you welcome these aspiring lads into the press box?
Sure. I think that when we talk about identity politics or multiculturalism and we talk about globalization, these are just veneers for neoliberalism. Trump, of course, has turbocharged neoliberalism. And what's really happened is that we have undergone, as John Ralston Saul says, a kind of corporate coup d'etat in slow motion. We saw the ruling elites epitomized by figures like Samuel Huntington when he attacked America's excess of democracy, terrified by the mobilization of the left in the 60s. And they, you had the Powell memo of 1971, which was the blueprint for this. But they built and they funded counter-institutions. And these counter-institutions delegitimized and marginalized critics of corporate capitalism and imperialism. Even Bernie Sanders couldn't touch that on the campaign trail.
We're going to get to it.
They used corporate money to buy the allegiances of the two parties, and they imposed this obedience to a neoliberal ideology within not only the parties, but within academia and the press.
But can I say, Chris, part of the problem in journalism is that you can't find the word neoliberalism in the New York Times. It's not an issue. It's not a name. People couldn't tell you what it's about.
Well, because it's like natural law. There's no questioning of it. It is assumed I know, I worked there for 15 years. I mean, it is synonymous with progress, and that's the problem.
What is the, I mean, I know Nathan Robinson a little longer than Julius, but he has been scathing, as you have been scathing for forever, about the tone of American journalism, and it doesn't deal in either big ideas or daily reality for most people. I'm looking at two young men who have the nerve to think there might be a cure here. How would you guide them? What's your rule of experience?
Well, the media landscape, especially the commercial electronic media, has been destroyed. It has become captive to a multi-billion-dollar-a-year industry that is designed and managed by public relations firms and publicists and communications departments to promote individuals or politicians or corporations.
Help them start the...
As Lippman said, it's about the manufacturing of public opinion. It's about the manufacturing of, creating pseudo-events and altering our perception of reality. And we're a culture, this is all before fake news, just utterly awash in lies.
Help these men restart a conversation, Chris. I mean, can we talk about Trumpism? Can we talk about ideas that, whether he emitted them or not, people somehow received impressions, body language, physical size, maybe his white male existence? But how do we cut through that to what could be the content that people absorb here?
He's a revenge on discredited elites. This neoliberal agenda, along with the expansion of imperial wars, these endless wars, have been pushed by both Democrats and Republicans. And you had that veneer, which was true in both parties, for the Bushes or the Clintons. They spoke in this kind of decorous language about democratic institutions, and long after money had replaced the vote and the consent of the governed had become a joke. And that's what people reacted against, both in terms of the insurgency by Bernie Sanders and the insurgency by Trump. It's this kind of 3 or 4 decade long piece of political theater has come undone, and it's not going to get glued back together. And Trump profited from that.
Julius Crane
profited from it the way right wing demagogues and populists always profit from decayed democratic institutions and systems.
I want to ask Julius, and maybe you want to coach him, Chris Hedges, but where is this enormous mystery, neoliberalism, on your agenda? I think of it as the marketization of everything, the markets for the sake, money for the sake of money, but it infects our education, it affects our culture, it affects medicine, it affects science. Where does
right,
that...
But let me just, Chris, let me just throw in there, it's a utopian ideology.
Okay.
The idea that banks and hedge funds and corporations, you know, that the dictates of the market should determine
yes.
how you configure a human society is ridiculous. And we're paying for this utopian ideology, which, as Thomas More said, is no place. It doesn't exist. All of the promises of neoliberalism have been exposed as a lie. That's part of this upheaval that you're seeing not only in the United States, but in Europe. I just came back from Eastern Europe. You're seeing around the globe. It doesn't promote democracy. It doesn't. Wealth doesn't trickle down. In fact, of course, it is an assault against democratic institutions. It doesn't create global communities. It creates global oligarchic elites. I mean, every single promise of neoliberalism has been exposed as false.
Julius Crane, where does American Affairs stand on neoliberalism?
Well, I agree with Mr. Hedges entirely. Before I answer fully, though, I just want to respond to...
On the utopian ideology? On the...
I'll get to that, but I just want to respond very briefly to the mischaracterization of American affairs that my other interlocutor offered before the break. This is not an attempt to put a gloss on Trump or anything like that. This is setting out our own ideas, our own critique of neoliberalism, and we will frankly publish authors who don't even like Trump but are interested in the underlying ideas.
No, now, Josh Mitchell said Trump could be a shining city on a hill.
He was one. He's one character that did. He's one author that did that.
Machiavellian virtue is your way of describing what Trump represents.
An image. You have to read carefully. I'm a Straussian.
Michael Anton, who has written for every issue of yours, is a massive. He's in the
There's
Trump
only been
administration.
One issue.
In the Journal of American Greatness, the predecessor to this, which is named after Trump's philosophy, Michael Anton was a very strong Trump supporter. He's now in the administration. Everything you've written is an attempt to give a coherent philosophy to the presidency of Donald Trump.
We're expressing our own coherent philosophy and hoping Trump reads it. But if you want to critique journalism for not being serious, I'd encourage you to keep reading it and keep an open mind. So far, I haven't seen that. Now, to get back to your question on neoliberalism, the critique of that is really the heart of American affairs. My essay looks at it through the lens of what is, you know, managerial capitalism and managerial politics. As I said, I agree with absolutely everything Mr. Hedges said, both with respect to the diminishing of democracy, both with respect to creating a sort of oligarchic, detached elite that does whatever it wants. And as well, I would add, as he did, identity politics plays a role here in that it sort of balkanizes the people and prevents a majoritarian confrontation with a lot of these neoliberal exploitation.
Julius, your own piece in the first issue of your magazine centers on, as you put it, the interests and character of the elite as a class. What do you mean by that?
What I just said, I think the class interests of the elite is what is called neoliberalism, and they have dressed it up, and perhaps they even believe that it is a set of policies that is good for everybody. But in fact, it serves their very own class interest, and it's just as ideological as everything else. And the fact that they claim it is some sort of non-ideological practical solution to everything is precisely the signal that it is the most ideological, perhaps even extreme ideological tendency operating today.
And what's your connection to, allegiance to, both the elite and the finance world coming out of Harvard and the money game?
Well, I know it, and I've seen it, and actually that's one. Bannon gave an interview where he said a similar thing, where being in this, you see a lot of people that don't care at all about their fellow citizens, don't care at all about the sort of slogans of democracy, or treat them as mere slogans. And I think there's sort of two kinds of people that come out of the finance world. Some truly believe in the slogans and increasing liquidity and efficient markets and all that. And others sort of see it as the game that it is, and recognize that what is operating today actually has nothing to do with Adam Smith's capitalism or the democratic capitalism of the American founders. And that, I think, has been an important part of the formation of my critique.
And why did you leave finance?
To start a journal.
That's progress. What's to be done about elite neoliberalism?
Well, tough to answer that in a few sentences, but I think actually the core things include a better trade policy, an interest-based foreign policy, and ultimately it comes down to a restoration of some sort of political community. I think that the left has to learn that you can't ground the economy in the community unless there is a community. And the right has to learn that we can't talk about all their cherished shibboleths like American exceptionalism or whatever if we're going to have an economy that is completely detached from any democratic community or accountability.
Your turn, Nathan, but do we take this literally or do we take it seriously, old puzzle around Donald Trump?
I tell you, what I do take literally is what Donald Trump actually does, right? So Mr. Krein's written that Donald Trump represents a reaction against elites that he, quote, terrifies the business class. I don't think that's true. I think Donald Trump is a gift to the business class. He immediately appointed a cabinet of billionaires. The stock market soaring. The business class loves Donald Trump. He doesn't represent any kind of threat to global financial elites. That's certain. But I think if we want to find out what Trumpism represents, we should look look at what Trump does. And that means cutting the refugee acceptance rate, sending refugees back to war zones to die. It means what they've just proposed in the last few days, separating mothers and children at detention centers specifically in order to make it to deter Central American refugees from fleeing gang violence, allowing ICE agents impunity, rescinding bringing back expedited removals so that people can be deported very, very, very quickly, cutting foreign aid, so the World Food Program, UNICEF, domestically, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is what, if you want to find out what Trump actually represents, what the ideas are, you should look at what he proposes and what he actually does. And what he proposes is massive increases in military spending, cuts in domestic spending, cuts in social programs, and a cruel and frankly barbaric policy towards the undocumented and towards refugees.
Your turn, Julius Krein. Connect the ideas here with the policies that are announced every other day, but also I want to get to Chris Hedges and the place of protest and resistance to the whole game. Is it too late for ideas is what I'm going to ask you, Chris. But first, make the connections that Nathan is talking about between so-called ideas and so-called policy.
Yeah, I agree. We should judge him by what he does. I don't actually think he's done much yet. I would be the first to admit that I think the refugee ban was a somewhat hasty publicity stunt that didn't even accomplish what it was supposed to.
It's not a publicity stunt.
If you believe in the merits of that, but I also think Obama let very few in until 2016, and I don't remember you complaining about it then.
I complained about Obama all the time.
Okay, but were you complaining about the refugee policy?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been perfectly consistent.
Well, congratulations. But yeah, I agree. I think, is he going to do something to fundamentally reshape our trade agreements? Are we going to have a better foreign policy? The infrastructure spending program, which you neglected to mention, the headline number is large. I agree. A lot of it seems to be sort of retroactive tax breaks and stuff that probably are not going to work. So I'm perfectly willing to wait and see what he does, and will critique what I disagree with. I just think that, you know, right now a lot of the government isn't even in place yet, which I don't completely understand why. I think it's unfortunate. I would like to see moving faster to get more of the government in place and moving more deliberately on affecting some of these larger changes, and hopefully doing it in a way that I think his voters wanted and that will benefit all Americans.
Julius, do you think his voting base is following ideas or gestures? Are they following your magazine or the Daily Circus and especially the wrestling match?
It's never that simple. It'll never be one or the other. But I think there is a weird sense in which I would be very contrarian and say a lot of people think Trump won on his sort of personality. I would actually say that Trump won by being just adequate enough a vessel of a certain sense of ideas, which, again, don't necessarily need to be articulated in a coherent or systematic way, but one can kind of gather from the overall arc, trade changes, more restrictive immigration, interest-based foreign policy, a revival of a sense of democratic sovereignty and political community that I think people did respond to.
Chris Hedges, is it too late for a battle of ideas? I mean, I think you're ready for a revolution against all this stuff, and you see the real action now in the street and in protest, in opposition.
Well, that's because we, as Sheldon Wolin pointed out, we don't have any institutions left that are authentically democratic. And what we've reached is this kind of late stage of capitalism, which, as Marx understood, was marked by global capital being unable to expand and generate profits at former levels. And as Marx wrote, at that point, capital begins to consume the host. It consumes government. It consumes physical and social structures that, in fact, sustain them. And so that's why you see this assault, $20 billion sucked out of the Department of Education, failure to invest in infrastructure, the selling off of Scranton, Pennsylvania, sells off its sewer system to a private company because it can't pay its creditors, and the unleashing very myopic and short-sighted unleashing of the assault against the ecosystem. All of this serves this mania for short-term profit, but it's deeply destructive, both in an economic and a physical sense. And I think this is the late stage of capitalism that Trump represents. And we have to remember that it isn't just Trump. He is ramming through a very right-wing reactionary agenda that has been with us for some time. Most of the state legislatures, most of the governorships are now in the hands of these people. And I think what we're going to see is a final, this is kind of the last great campaign of corporate pillaging. And it's going to be as crass and as brazen as, all those people Trump fleeced at his casinos who were hoping for a miracle in the face of dead-end jobs and personal debts, or who shelled out all their money for Trump University. What we're going to get is a kind of naked kleptocracy, and that's, Greek kratos, which means thieves, or klepto, which means thieves, and kratos, which means rule, so it's literally ruled by thieves. I think it's going to rival kleptocracies by Suharto or Marcos, not just in terms of Trump and his family, who will, of course, see their wealth expand, but more importantly, in terms of those corporations that will suck hundreds of billions of federal dollars. We're seeing it with the expansion of the arms industry out of the federal government. I mean, they're gonna harvest everything.
We're gonna look at Social Security,
and that process. There are no mechanisms within the structures of power,
and no ideas to cure them. Chris, hang on, we'll be back. Coming up, a checklist of the big issues which you or I might want to test budding opinion makers on. Starting, to keep it essential, with three E words: the economics of neoliberalism, the egalitarian idea of American life, and the empire question. This is Open Source. Current Affairs is the magazine that our guest Nathan Robinson inaugurated to cover the 2016 campaign. He called it for Donald Trump a year ago when Hillary Clinton had been awarded the race by the mainstream press. American Affairs is the new quarterly that Julius Krein presented to the world this week. I spoke of a checklist. Let's start with you, Nathan. We've spoken in an introductory way about economics and neoliberalism. Where on your priority list would be the egalitarian premise, ideal, surely, of American democracy? And then the question of the hegemonic empire of the United States.
Yeah, so I think it's absolutely true that we live in an era of really extraordinary inequality, where it's almost a new Gilded Age in which we have people living in just unprecedented wealth at a time of great suffering around the world and in our own country, where people feel excluded and abandoned and betrayed. And so I think, the egalitarian idea, restoring a sense of egalitarianism, eliminating or at least significantly reducing financial economic inequality and the wealth gap, but also giving people a sense that they have an equal stake in American institutions.
Are we onto it yet?
No, because Donald Trump seems to me to be a massive reaction or a force against that completely. I mean, I haven't heard.
But you also thought Bernie Sanders would have beaten him in a final election.
Yeah,
I think
that's absolutely true, because I think when you have a time like that, when you have a period where people are hurting, where people are frustrated and disaffected, you can go one of two ways. You can retreat into bigotry and nationalism and cruelty, which is what Trump preyed on very successfully to get people's votes, or you can give people a very hopeful idea of togetherness and an idea that we're gonna build institutions that are gonna help everyone, and ideas for how we're gonna do that, how we're gonna help you go to college, how we're gonna help you get a good job. Donald Trump doesn't have any ideas like that. He doesn't really have any ideas at all, other than building a wall and dropping bombs.
Speak to the empire question in general. As Chris Hedges said, even Bernie Sanders didn't want to go very far down that road.
Yeah, it's difficult to say, right? Donald Trump pretended during the campaign that he opposed the Iraq war when he hadn't. So it's difficult to know what he's going to do in foreign policy, because he's suggested that he's a critic of foreign intervention. I mean, at the same time, we just had this raid in Yemen recently that killed women and children. It's not clear whether he will represent a break from the American foreign policy consensus, or whether he will be a more restrained non-interventionist, as he said he's going to be. But it's difficult to reconcile that with a massive increase in military spending, as he's proposed, and with antagonizing China. Steve Bannon says we're going to go to war in the South China Sea. So difficult to know yet. The only thing we do know is that nothing Trump says can ever be trusted.
Julius Krein, on your agenda, where does the egalitarian premise come in economics, but also in culture? And then the empire matter.
Yes, I think it is. I think it is both an economic and a cultural question, and let's leave Trump himself out of it for a moment, because again, that's actually a question that's only of secondary importance to me. But I do think if I have a critique of the left, it's only that, you know, when you talk about building institutions where people have an equal stake and things like that, you actually do have to have some sense of community. And that means you have citizens. And that means that a government is responsive to those citizens first, rather than others. And, you know, for all the problems that you want to point out at Trump, I think the message that people do respond to is this sense that American citizenship matters, if you will. And on the question of empire, We can say whether he was really sincere in his opposition to the Iraq war or whatever, but the fact is he criticized it very strongly, much more strongly than others did. Perhaps coming from the right and hearing this as a breath of fresh air, I'm inclined to give him more of the benefit of the doubt than maybe I should. But I do think that his critique of this sort of neoconservative ideas-based foreign policy that had become abstracted from any sense of a concrete national interest was actually a very successful criticism, and that policy, that former policy, was a failure. So I hope that
I think you're right about that. In the campaign, he wasted Jeb Bush first and then Hillary Clinton for the Iraq war. And what he said on a radio show, it was so unclear, and I'm not sure it would have mattered anyway. Chris Hedges, how do we sharpen the arguments around equality and empire? What's the mission for these young men?
Well, I think we need a vision, which we don't have. I speak as a member of the left. This movement, Indivisible, is essentially hoping that Trump will implode and Democratic elites like Schumer, who's spent his entire career carrying suitcases of cash from Wall Street to Democratic candidates, will step in to fill the void. I don't think that's going to work. I think it's very naive. We see on the press this false narrative that somehow Trump was elected because of the Podesta emails, as if tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of Clinton supporters woke up and read the Podesta emails and decided to vote for Trump, which is ridiculous, or they watched RT, where I have a show, and they voted for the Green Party. It was the 7 pages and the director of National Intelligence report. It's just also ridiculous. And they're not dealing with the root causes of what drove people into the arms of the Sanders campaign, drove people in the arms of the Trump campaign. And I think that many of these demonstrations, some of which I've attended, the March on Washington and the March on Trump Tower, these are Democratic stalwarts. They're East Coast elitists who, largely like the West Coast, have profited off of the destructive power of neoliberalism and deindustrialization. We're going to have to begin to speak in another language. We're going to have to address those economic and ideological forces that have driven half the country into poverty.
I'm glad you mentioned
in a real way, and that's certainly not coming from the liberal establishment.
You're right. I'm glad you introduced the phrase false narrative. The New York Times has gone to war against fake news, but it's full of false narrative.
Right.
The Russiagate story sort of obsessed us this week. I mean, there it is. And people feel they have to take it up. They have to believe that Putin did this to us. It, so transparently, just a sort of displacement of thinking, but also talk to anybody who knows the Russia-American situation on almost any part of the spectrum, Russian or American, and they'll say it's nonsense. It's absurd. Even as WikiLeaks reveals our meddling in almost anything, we're talking about Russian hacking. There's a level of absurdity in the formal conversation, and I wonder how these guys and anybody else can break through it. What is the freeze there?
The problem is that you have a corporate-controlled media, and I include public broadcasting. PBS is a subsidiary of the Koch brothers.
In some towns, it is.
Yeah, we've destroyed the space by which people who are not beholden to the business interests or to the political class had a platform. You go back to the 60s, you could watch Chomsky or Zinn, even Malcolm X on public broadcasting. That doesn't happen now. And so,
Noam Chomsky has a standing invitation to this program. I just want to serve notice. It's very hard to get.
But the problem is that you've reduced, there's a deep cynicism on this commercial corporate media where you have a host called a journalist, celebrity journalist who makes $10 million a year or something. It's all about horse racing, you know, who's ahead, who's not, who's got more money, or who's going to be appointed, and it's all this kind of speculation, or it's the banal and the trivial and the ridiculous. And the airwaves are just glutted with this garbage. Newspapers are atrophying and dying.
This is the funny part. They are dying, and they're, as they sink, the cynicism somehow grows deeper, not more desperately risky. Chris, I wanted to put it to the... Go ahead.
But let me just throw in that it sinks because as those papers go into crisis, they cater even more obsequiously to the elites because they need the advertising.
I wonder if the young men entering this business are somehow immune, or how do you fight the cynicism? But is there a zeal, I hope, simply to tell this, you know, believe your lion eyes and tell people what you see?
I agree with most of what Hedges said there. I actually think that it's an opportunity for us because especially as, and again, we're more ideas and essays rather than news. We don't do any news. But as especially the other media have really shrunk and everything has condensed really almost down to Twitter catfights, there is a hunger for serious long-form essays attempting to think through these very difficult questions. And we're going to provide that. And so far, there's been a lot of interest from readers, from very high-quality writers, and even from radio interviewers.
We know it's true. Is it not, Nathan? And the response to your magazine, I'd say, is, wow, what a gust of fresh air.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the trust in media is at an all-time low, and there's a real discrediting of the traditional mainstream media. And for those of us who are starting independent ventures, it is a promising time, and I think there is a real hunger for something that is true and honest and fair-minded. I mean, I think the real thing that people want and that we certainly are trying to give them is a sense of integrity, especially among the liberal media. There is a sense that there's no integrity because they reflexively criticize Trump. They're not fair to Trump. And so we try and be always keep our criticisms fair and grounded in factual reality. But also at the same time, you don't want to. The real thing that people don't want is they don't want reflexive ideological filterings of the truth, whether that is whitewashing Trump's crimes and downplaying what the human consequences of his policies for people, or whether that is conjuring conspiracy theories about him and Putin that fall apart under any scrutiny.
I want to put a single question to you, Julius, that comes up in your magazine, and it comes all around Trump. America first. the return of nationalism, and whatever that means. Your man, Joshua Mitchell, from Georgetown, writes about distinguishing liberal nationalism and, what did he say, covenantal nationalism, well-considered patriotism, cosmopolitan liberalism. What's he driving at? What is he illuminating about the Trump notion of nationalism?
Well, again, I don't know that it's a Trump notion. It's his notion, and he would be better to answer this than I. But the contrast he's trying to make is between a sense of liberal nationalism, which is a sort of constellation of abstract principles detached from any particular history, et cetera, and a sense of covenantal nationalism, which really grows out of a long American history, which, as he would be the first to point out, includes both slavery and the Civil War, both Jim Crow and the Civil Rights Movement. But it's connected to a particular history and a particular people with a particular future.
As opposed to
general abstract truths that are believed to be sort of universally applicable to everyone, everywhere, all the time.
What does he mean by a confrontation coming with identity politics?
Again, I think it's this notion of, we have this, to go back to the sub-state and the super-state, the sort of converse of globalism is identity politics, where one doesn't take one's political rights or notion of citizenship or value from belonging to the larger national social contract, but from a sort of given identity and a kind of narrative of victimhood that's assigned to that. And his view, at least, is that the notion of identity politics is very destructive to a common identity and also to the groups it's purported to benefit.
Judas, last question for you. You have invested heavily in the notion that Trump means these things about anti-imperialism and maybe even working folk. I've been tempted by that to sort of give him a break feeling myself. What if you and I are completely wrong, that he is a bounder, a predator, a front for the corporate class? And who's going to tell the people?
Well, even if we're completely wrong, I believe I'll still have started a magazine that unites people from the nominal right and left in a new critique of neoliberalism. And then we'll also critique Trump. So it's fine with me. Obviously, I hope that doesn't happen because I think it'd be very bad for the country and very bad for everybody.
I'm dying to see not just a critique of neoliberalism, but for starters, an inventory of the symptoms, the innumerable expressions of neoliberalism. Could we get it, Nathan?
Well, yeah, although I think there are two kinds of critiques of neoliberalism. You can have the humanist or critique which goes after neoliberalism for its failure to provide to the weakest and most vulnerable and its enriching of elites at the expense of the larger mass of humanity. But then you can have what Mr. Cronin promotes, which is a kind of nationalist reaction to neoliberalism. A nationalism which to me is the most pernicious form of identity politics, because nationalism combined with the state, what that ends up meaning in practice is precisely what Trump is doing, which is ferreting out people who are perceived to be too different, who are perceived to be too far from this abstract notion of our common communal identity, and singling them out to be stereotyped, to be harassed, and to be deported. And that's why in magazines like American Affairs, you see Michael Anton, who says things like, what good has Muslim immigration done for the United States? And I think that's the real danger, is that the critique of neoliberalism will bleed into this kind of ultimately bigoted and racist nationalism, which I think does nobody any good. And so this is why the left needs to examine itself and needs to put forward a positive critique of neoliberalism.
Chris Hedges, the last word. Maybe of encouragement, but can we imagine a more open conversation here?
Well, the last column I wrote was the best allies Trump and these reactionaries have is a liberal class that continues to play this game.
Which game?
And I would agree that we have to step out of the confines of the liberal establishment and the Democratic Party to provide an honest critique and a real alternative. Otherwise, we're going to end up with an Americanized fascism.
Might we find it in journalism before we get to the streets or not?
Well, you might find it in journalism, but you kind of look pretty hard because mainstream journalism, I mean, you've watched it as I have since we're both at one point at the New York Times. I mean, the degradation of journalism has been quite profound, even within my lifetime. And
we're done, Chris, for the moment. Thank you, Nathan Robinson, Julius Krein, and Chris Hedges. Our show was produced this week by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Becca DiGregorio, and Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.